WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, launched from Lebanon's Bekaa Valley, operating in the criminal underworld of South America and the suburbs of the USA. They are one of the world's most notorious terrorist groups. This hour, inside Hezbollah. We begin with the latest on the collapse today of Israel's governing coalition. Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, Defense Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer, and other Labor Party ministers walked out of Ariel Sharon's government after a dispute over funding for Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. I spoke with Dan Efron, Jerusalem correspondent for the Boston Globe. I asked him about the implications of the collapse of Prime Minister Sharon's Likud-Labor coalition.
In the short run, it means that Sharon no longer has this broad and fairly stable government. I think in the long run, it means that he's either going to have to get by with a narrow government that leans on parties from the far right, or he's going to have to call an election, and that might happen pretty soon, maybe as soon as January.
What do the polls look like if there is an election as soon as that? How does Sharon look placed?
Well, that's one of the interesting things about this. Sharon actually might get a boon from this political crisis. The polls for his party, for his Likud party, show that Likud would gain about 20% in parliament at the expense of Labor, at Ben-Eliezer's party, at the expense of his party. And Sharon personally is doing very well. His approval rating is high. He's going to have to face an internal primary election in Likud against the former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And really, for the first time in about a year, polls show that he's on top by about 10 or 12 points. So he's doing all right.
If the Likud is likely to do so well out of a breakup of the coalition, tell us again why the Labor Party stirred up this ruckus.
The Labor Party, Ben-Eliezer in particular, is talking about allocations to settlers. It's about $145 million in the 2003 budget that has been earmarked for Jewish settlers in the West Bank, and that was the bone of contention. It was the issue that Ben-Eliezer chose to leave the government. But I think what analysts believe here is that Ben-Eliezer is motivated more by internal party politics. He's facing his own primary election in 3 weeks in November, and he is trailing to two candidates who are more dovish than he is, and I think he wanted to feel that he could burnish his dovish credentials by showing that on this issue he was attacking settlers.
If the outcome of all this may be a smaller Labor Party, does that mean that the settlement issue is not really resonating, that the Labor Party message is not really resonating with the Israeli public in the way that it has in the past?
It's complicated, actually. I think that on the one hand, it certainly is true that in the last 2 years, during this period of fighting with the Palestinians, the Israeli body politic or popular opinion has shifted to the right towards people like Sharon and away from the Labor Party. But on the other hand, one of the things you see is people in the middle and even in the right saying that these Jewish settlements, these 200,000 Jewish settlers who populate the West Bank and Gaza, that is an untenable situation. So I think that there are two things almost at cross currents going on at once.
That must be a lot of internal contradiction for people to keep in mind. If they're untenable, on the other hand, Ariel Sharon has been quite a champion of settlements.
Sharon has been a champion of settlements. I think that as long as he presided over this broad government, this national unity government, there were checks and balances. And one of the things that Labor did was attenuated, at least to some extent, the growth in these settlements. I think what some people in the center on the left are worried about is now that Labor is out, there will be kind of a large-scale expansion of these Jewish settlements.
What other implications might there be if a new ruling coalition has a more right-wing lean?
Well, I think that the first thing and the obvious thing is that any effort to liven or revive the dialogue with the Palestinians will go out the window. There hasn't been much of that anyway, even with what amounts to a kind of a right-center government. But if we see a narrow coalition, Sharon and parties to the right of him, we're probably not going to see any kind of diplomacy. Now, the United States in the last couple of weeks has put forward a proposal to get the two sides at least back to the bargaining table. It's a long-term proposal. It envisions 2 or 3 years of negotiation and ultimately a Palestinian state. It's very gradual. It's very subtle. But even that kind of proposal is a non-starter for what would be a narrow government.
Dan, how do you think an Israeli election early next year might interact with a potential U.S. attack on Iraq? And if a more right-wing coalition emerges, how might that influence Israel's behavior during a war with Iraq?
I'm not sure that it would influence Israel's behavior. We saw in 1991 during the Gulf War a very right-wing government headed by Yitzhak Shamir restraining itself and not responding to Iraqi attacks. But I think the issue of an election perhaps during a campaign in Iraq, an American campaign in Iraq, or just before, would give Israelis the jitters. It's probably not the time that Israelis want to be going to the polls or want to see a new government adjusting itself. And so that might determine the actual date of elections. If Sharon and Ben Eliezer get together and agree on a date, we might see it, rather than January, being put off to March or April.
Dan Efron, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dan Efron is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. He spoke with me earlier today from Jerusalem. When Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982, the goal was to remove Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement from its stronghold in southern Lebanon. Israel succeeded, and Israeli troops under Ariel Sharon stayed put. When Lebanese Shiites realized Sharon had no intention of leaving, they took up arms and soon produced the most successful terrorist group in modern history, the Hezbollah, or Party of God. Over the next 20 years, Hezbollah played a key role in pushing Israel out of Lebanon. It became a role model for terror groups around the world, invented the multi-pronged terror attack, killed 241 U.S. Marines in Beirut, mastered the guerrilla art of mega bombs, built its own satellite TV channel that relentlessly reports Palestinian suffering and goads violent action against Israel. Until September 11th last year, Hezbollah had killed more Americans than any other terrorist organization, but their primary target is, and always has been, Israel. In the supercharged borderlands between Beirut and Tel Aviv, Hezbollah waits to strike. And Israel waits to strike too. If the U.S. goes to war with Iraq, both may see their chance. Question is Washington fighting, if it's fighting a war on terror, should it be fighting Hezbollah? And will a U.S. attack on Iraq be the starting gun for an open Israeli-Hezbollah war? Did you know Hezbollah has cells in the heart of South America, of the USA? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Jeffrey Goldberg, staff writer for The New Yorker. He recently wrote in The Party of God, a two-part article on Hezbollah that appeared in October issues of The New Yorker. He's also written for The New York Times Magazine and The Jerusalem Post. Welcome and good evening, Jeffrey Goldberg.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. Jeffrey Goldberg, that was an incredible piece of journalism. I really take my hat off to you. You dug deep and you brought, at least for me, out a lot of detail that I had never heard, and more than detail, a kind of a whole picture of Hezbollah that took me way past what I had heard out of Washington and gave me a much bigger view of it. How long did you spend reporting this piece? You were in South America, you were in the Middle East, you're around the United States. It must have been a huge undertaking.
Several months, I would say. A month in the Middle East, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks in South America. They're a worldwide global terror organization, so you have to travel to go find them.
I guess I want to put the headline that is the question that is the headline of your first article to you first, and we'll come back and look at the detail here. But
sure.
Writ large, here's your headline. Are terrorists in Lebanon preparing for a larger war? Well, are they?
Yes, they are preparing for a larger war. Whether that war comes to pass is that remains to be seen. Although I would, if I had a bet, I would say yes, that's going to happen. The pressure is building, and you know, because of our focus on our dual focus, if you will, on Iraq and on Al Qaeda, we forget about that particular conflict. But what's happened is over the past several months, Hezbollah has moved into the border area you talk about.
Just north of Israel, the southern area of Lebanon.
Just north of Israel, right, exactly, the Lebanese-Israeli border.
And as you describe it, it's literally just north. I mean, they are parked right on the borderline.
Oh, Hezbollah, I mean, you know, it's a fascinating thing. I spent a lot of time on both sides of the border, obviously on separate trips because the border is completely sealed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite remarkable because you could walk up to the fence on the Lebanese side and see Israeli soldiers 30 feet away and vice versa. So it's quite astonishing. It's really and the thing that I want to stress, and I want to come back to this this buildup on the border. Mm-hmm. The thing that struck me when first time I went there was that it's not in fact Lebanon's border with Israel, but it's in a very serious way Iran's border with Israel, because Hezbollah is not an independent terror organization. Hezbollah is the definition, if you will, of a state-sponsored terror organization, and its primary state sponsor is Iran. So on the border with Israel, mm-hmm. you find portraits not of Lebanon's prime minister or president, but of Ayatollah Khomeini facing right into Israel, 20, 30 feet away. Mm.
State-sponsored terrorism, which we hear George W. Bush talking a lot about, but we don't hear him talking a lot about Syria and Iran in the context of the war on terror. Jeffrey Goldberg, take us back, if you would. Give us the quick history of Hezbollah and explain in the context of that how its sponsorship from Syria and Iran came to be.
Okay. That's a big question. Hezbollah grew out of a couple of different events, the two most important events. By far the most important event was the rise of Shiite fundamentalism in Iran. 1979. Of course, people remember that because of the embassy takeover.
Would you describe as leaving Shiites euphoric right across the Middle East?
Sure. The Shiites in Lebanon make up half the population, and they're the most economically depressed, despised. I would call them a minority, except they probably make up more than half of the country at this mm-hmm. point. That revolution in 1979 really inspired them to take charge of their. To take charge of their political lives, and it inspired the more fanatic among them to take up arms. Add to that the 1982 invasion of Lebanon by Menachem Begin's army, by Ariel Sharon, in effect.
Which you call a crucial element in sparking the kind of coalescing of this movement.
Absolutely, and there's a fascinating thing, because people would automatically assume, I think, that the Shiites were, from the get-go, opposed to this invasion. In fact, southern Lebanon, until 1982, until that Israeli invasion, was majority Shiite, mm-hmm. but it was controlled by the PLO, by Yasser Arafat's mm-hmm. organization.
Which is why Israel went in.
Excuse me?
Which is why Israel went in.
Exactly, which is why Israel went in. They were firing rockets, so the PLO was firing rockets into Israel from that area. The Shiites couldn't stand the Palestinians. The Palestinians ran that area as a kind of a gangster state. And so literally when the Israeli tanks rolled through, the Shiites of the villages in the south came out and threw rice and rose water on these Israelis. The Israeli mistake was, of course, to stay.
For 18 years.
They expelled the PLO, but then, of course, they stayed. And, of course, everyone remembers that history. Sharon went much further than he promised, went all the way to Beirut, and, you know, we understand the ramifications of that to this day.
And the Syria-Iran links quickly?
Syria and Iran. Well, Iran's link is obvious. Iran is the prime funder, sponsor, protector mm-hmm. of the organization, has been from the outset. Syria uses Hezbollah as its own sort of militia in Lebanon. Syria, of course, occupies Lebanon now, and it uses Hezbollah as a proxy in its ongoing war, Cold War, with Israel. In other words, Syria doesn't fire the rockets, mm-hmm. but it provides the rockets to Hezbollah, which then fires the rockets onto Israel.
And Hezbollah believes, or at least likes to say, that it will take Israel down. You quote the leader of Hezbollah saying that Israel, despite its nuclear weapons and the strongest air force in the region, is more fragile than a spider web.
This is their belief. This is a profound belief of Hezbollah. Many people assumed in the year 2000, when Israel finally withdrew its forces from Lebanon, that the withdrawal would moderate Hezbollah's view of the world. It didn't. It actually strengthened it mm-hmm. because the Israeli pullout, which was seen here in Washington as a sign of common sense moderation on the part of the prime minister at the time, Ehud mm-hmm. Barak, was seen by Hezbollah as an admission of defeat. Hezbollah took the lesson from that took the lesson that, you know, we can beat these guys. We can beat them all the way to Jerusalem.
A lesson that they're now broadcasting everywhere. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with author Jeffrey Goldberg about Hezbollah, the second front in the war on terror. Maybe it should be the first front. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Is this the real enemy? And whose enemy? Israel's? America's? Both? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Hezbollah, the second front in the war on terror. Perhaps it should be the first front, bigger than Al-Qaeda, badder than Iraq. Our guest tonight is Jeffrey Goldberg. He's staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, has had a couple of eye-popping articles in The New Yorker in the last 2 weeks about Hezbollah's presence on Israel's northern border in southern Lebanon and worldwide. Is this the real enemy, Hezbollah? Whose enemy? Is it Israel's? Is it America's? Is it both? And if Iran and Syria are sponsoring Hezbollah, why aren't they Washington's big targets? Will they be next? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to welcome into our conversation right now Senator Bob Graham, Democrat from Florida and Chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Good evening and welcome, Senator Graham.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Bob Graham, you were quoted in Jeffrey Goldberg's article saying we should tell the Syrians that we expect them to shut down the Bekaa Valley camps, that is, of the Hezbollah, and saying that the Hezbollah front should perhaps be the first front, as I read you here, in the war on terror. Are we going after the right target? Do we have our priorities straight?
Well, if you ask the question, should Iraq be not only our highest target, but almost our only target. I have defined that as being the equivalent in 1938 of the European powers in London and Paris declaring war on Italy, but not declaring war on Germany. I think Hezbollah represents a much more serious threat to the people of the United States at home and our interest in the region of the Middle East and Central Asia than does Iraq.
Describe that threat as materially as you can, Senator Bob.
Well, I would describe the threat as having three components. One, Hezbollah has demonstrated its willingness, its enthusiasm to kill Americans. Prior to September the 11th, more Americans have been killed by Hezbollah than any other international terrorist group. Number two, the access which Hezbollah has to substantial financial resources and assumedly weapons of mass destruction through Iran, and third, the large number of Hezbollah operatives who are located in the United States, many of them prepared to conduct terrorist operations inside our country.
Do you see Hezbollah as currently on the American target list?
No, it's not. In fact, that was my frustration in the debate that we had on the Iraq resolution. The President of the United States, by virtue of a resolution passed on September the 18th of 2001, has authority to use force against those nations, organizations, or persons who were complicit in September the 11th. To date, the only organization that has been so identified is Al-Qaeda. We gave the president less than 30 days ago the authority to use force against Iraq. What we haven't done is give the president the authority to use force against Hezbollah and that other cluster of Middle Eastern terrorist groups, which have those same three characteristics of killing Americans, access to funds and potentially weapons of mass destruction, and with a significant presence inside the United States.
But as far as I know, the President of the United States did not seek authority
to
go after those groups.
I think that was a very serious error.
Why is that? Is the United States afraid because they can't afford to open up fronts with Iran and Syria and everyone?
Well, I don't know what the rationale was, but particularly in the context that a national intelligence assessment, which is a consensus assessment of all of the intelligence agencies, indicated that if we put Saddam Hussein in the position where he is facing the end of his regime, it is precisely at that point that he becomes the most dangerous. And one of the ways in which he would express that danger would be to strike out at the United States, in the United States, by forming alliances with international terrorist groups which have a presence in the United States and the ability to engage in terrorist activities. My feeling is that before we start this war against Iraq, and unless we secure a resolution from the United Nations that Saddam Hussein will agree to abide by, we may be facing a war against Iraq within the next 75 to 80 days. That's the amount of time that we've got to deal effectively with these sleepers who are inside the United States, as well as initiate action against the headquarters of these organizations, mainly in the Middle East, in order to cut off their ability to provide financial, logistical, and other support.
Senator Graham, I know we just have you for another minute, and I want to ask you, Jeff Goldberg has described how Hezbollah thrived in the aftermath of Israel's invasion of southern Lebanon. Given that history, how do you see the military element in solving this problem? Is it 90% of what our response to Hezbollah should be military? Is it something less than that? How effective can a military solution be?
I think it needs to be a combination of intelligence, military, and diplomatic. As I indicated, I visited Syria and Lebanon in July of this year, and I met with the president of Syria and raised the issue of the training camps, which in Afghanistan were the seed corn of al-Qaeda. And I said, we have reason to believe that these training camps are in operation in Syria and in the Syrian-controlled areas.
Bekaa Valley and so on.
He denied that there were such training camps, saying the only training he knew of were training people for humanitarian purposes. I think we need to be very clear with the leadership of Syria that we expect them to take the first responsibility to deal with the terrorists within that country and their training camps. But if they fail to do so, we reserve the right to do it for them.
Senator Bob Graham, Florida Democrat and chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
It's been great having you. Jeff Goldberg, describe the threat to Israel that Hezbollah poses at this point. As you point out, they make no bones about wanting to see Israel go down. Can they accomplish it? What capacity do they have?
Well, they can't. I mean, they can't accomplish it anytime soon. They believe that Israeli society is weak and that they will eventually, Israel might collapse of its own accord with a little push from groups like Hezbollah. Hezbollah has the ability, and this is a very important point, it kind of feeds into what the senator was saying. Hezbollah has the ability to supply bombs, so-called mega bombs, to its own cells inside Israel, or also to Hamas and Islamic Jihad.
Bombs capable of bringing down large structures, towers.
Large structures or killing several hundred people. There have been three attempts so far, two attempts to blow up a fuel depot in Tel Aviv. The notion is that if Hezbollah can kill several hundred Israelis, that would force Israel to launch a war against not only Lebanon, but against, more importantly, against Syria. A wider Arab-Israeli war at this moment, of course, is the last thing that the Bush administration wants or needs. It would obviously preempt, postpone, however you want to call it, an American attack on Iraq.
Although you suggested an American attack on Iraq, and this Israel-Hezbollah conflict, the chemistry may interact directly, that Hezbollah might take the opportunity of an American attack on Iraq to attack Israel. They have missiles, you report, that may be able to reach into the industrial heartland of Israel.
Right.
On the other hand, Israel might look in the fury of war to try and deal with a problem that's been a real thorn in their side and go after Hezbollah.
Absolutely. We're in a very extraordinary moment because Israeli military doctrine, defense doctrine, makes it absolutely clear that Israel does not tolerate the presence of thousands of short and medium range rockets right on its border.
Yet they're doing that.
But and that's what's happening. The only reason Israel hasn't attacked is because the Americans have told them, please don't attack.
And if they do attack, you point out, it means also attacking Syria, and at some point, Iran comes into play.
Iran does come into play, although Syria would be the immediate Israeli target. Mm-hmm. And the Israelis have made it very clear. They made it clear in interviews to me, including the general in command of that front, say that, you know, Syria is the address. We'll go after Hezbollah, but Syria is the real address. And so Israel has made it very clear to Syria that it arms and pushes Hezbollah at its own peril.
It seems to hold out the prospect of a war that could mushroom very quickly in unexpected directions. Abed is on the line. Welcome, Abed. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Good evening.
Thanks for taking my call. It is a very interesting subject, and I guess 1 hour is not really big enough.
It's what we've got, but what's your question, Abed?
All right. I actually come from South Lebanon. I've in South Lebanon. My town was occupied by Israel for mm-hmm. 20 years or plus, mm-hmm. And they just got out from my town recently in the last pullout.
So how do you see the Hezbollah? Do you see them as terrorists, or do you see them in them? They also have, as Jeffrey Goldberg points out, a more social service-oriented face.
Absolutely. They have universities that teaches the first university that's probably going to be teaching medical schools and stuff like that in the Middle East as well. So they're not an organization that teaches terror.
Excuse me, I want to be sure, Abed. Do you mean that they don't teach terror anywhere? Are you suggesting that?
I don't think so myself. I don't think so myself. Let's put that
point to Abed, to Jeffrey Goldberg. Hang on, Abed. We'll come back to you. But Jeffrey Goldberg, you've just been in the region talking with Hezbollah. Give us the evidence that you bring back of teaching terrorism.
Well, the evidence is incontrovertible. They've killed approximately 370 Americans over the past 20 years, including Americans many of us have all heard of. Robert Steedham, the Navy diver on TWA 847 in 1985. Buckley, the CIA station chief in Beirut, who was tortured and murdered by Hezbollah. The Marines, of course, as you mentioned, the American Embassy in Beirut.
And the training
Their record is not – it's not in dispute that they've killed hundreds of Americans in terror acts.
But the training function, I think, is what we're talking about here.
That's beyond – as Senator Graham said, that's not – in dispute in among Western intelligence agencies. Putting aside Israel and what its concerns are, Western intelligence agencies unanimously believe that the Bekaa Valley, under the control of Hezbollah and Syria, is one of the main centers of terrorist training in the world.
Does Hezbollah formally deny an involvement in terrorism, even at that level?
It formally denies involvement in terrorism. That's correct.
But you talked with very high-ranking people in Hezbollah, including the spiritual leader, who seemed to describe as his goal getting rid of Israel.
Well, you know, one man's – what's that expression? One man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. I happen to have a pretty absolute standard of what terrorism is, and by my standard, they commit terrorism. And, of course, the I believe that the goal, a policy goal of the destruction of Israel and the killing and dispersal of its 5 million Jewish citizens is a terrorist goal.
Abed, but do I hear you saying you do not see Hezbollah as terrorist?
No, I do not see Hezbollah as a terrorist group. I see is Israel terrorizing civilians on the Lebanese land. Israel went into Lebanon three times. They occupied all the way up to Beirut. They were responsible for actually the massacres in Shatila camps. Mm. They were actually guarding the camps.
These are the massacres that, as you report, Jeffrey Goldberg, Ariel Sharon was censored for supporting the Lebanese Christians who went into the camps.
Right, the Christian phalange.
And
yes.
the person who was supposed to testify against Sharon was blown up only a couple months ago with like 500 pounds of TNT in his car.
I might point out that no one has taken claim for responsibility for that act.
Yeah, we understand. I understand too. Yeah. And just for the record, that Lebanon is the only country that has not declared war on Israel yet.
No, actually, that's not. Lebanon and Israel are in a technical state of war. That is since 1948, I believe.
Abed, thank you for your call. Mark's on the line. Welcome, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I read the article, part of the first article, and it was totally fascinating. I mean, but, you know, here's my question. And it feels like this is like an Americanization of Israel's fight to some degree.
Hmm.
And I'm looking at a French failure in Vietnam, not to say that Israel failed in Lebanon, but, you know, now we're kind of being drugged into, to back the Israelis in a wider war in the area that cleans house for them. And, you know, it's more American blood and treasure, you know, in a really bad neighborhood that I'm not that interested in going to. And, you know, if people want to live there, I won't stop them. But and at the same time, we don't ever handle this whole Palestinian thing.
Mark, it's an interesting, very interesting observation. Stick with us. I want to get Jeffrey Goldberg's response. Jeffrey Goldberg, you write carefully about this line about where the conflict is directed, about how it's primarily at Israel, but there's also, as you point out, many Americans who have died here. Is this what Mark describes it as, an Americanization of Israel's fight, or is it, as Senator Graham said, something of vital importance to the United States as well?
Well, I think Senator Graham is onto something there. The feeling on the part of many senior officials in this administration, Senator Graham's statements notwithstanding, the feeling is very strong that Hezbollah is a current danger to the United States. The Hezbollah has been a danger to the U.S., completely apart from the U.S. The question of U.S. support for Israel. That Hezbollah, as an Iranian backed organization, is hostile to the U.S. for any number of reasons, and that if the Iranians choose to use Hezbollah against the United States or its interests, the Iranians could do that at a moment's notice. And that's why so many people in Washington are talking about Hezbollah in the manner that Senator Graham is talking about Hezbollah.
Mark, in spite of that, are you looking for a different solution? What would it be?
Well, I the problem I see with this, and I think, you know, I'm not to say that there isn't a real threat, but it seems like there's no way on the Arab street that we can act and somehow appear like something other than the Crusades, you know, coming in to this area again and the West asserting its will and having Israel there as kind of the base of operations. I'm not saying that there isn't a real threat and that this isn't the address where we may need to go knocking on to solve the Hezbollah problem here in the United States even. But
it's not a tar baby you're eager to engage with.
It's not going
to
play well. You know, we it seems that we continue to dig our a bigger and bigger hole in the Middle East for the United States in terms of foreign policy.
Mark, thank you for your call. Jeffrey Goldberg, is there any way at this point to draw a line between American interest and Israeli interest? Can Israel handle this fight alone?
Oh, of course. Yeah, there's no question about that. Hezbollah is in the south, has several hundred men and several thousand rockets. Israel has the most powerful army in the Middle East. Syria's army, which would obviously be engaged in this fight should it happen, is an army that lost its primary sponsor, the Soviet Union, about 12 years ago. It has a pretty ramshackle army. I think the caller is a little bit confused. Israel is not asking the U.S. to go fight this particular war.
But Senator Graham is standing up and saying he's ready to do it, that we need to do it.
Well, he's ready to do it for, as I hear him and I've interviewed him, he's ready to do it for American reasons. Mm-hmm. You have to remember something, and we have short memories in the United States, but in Washington, there are very strong constituencies for going after Hezbollah. These are the constituencies, the CIA, the Navy, that have lost people in terror attacks committed by Hezbollah.
They don't forget. Jeffrey Goldberg, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about Hezbollah, the second front in the war on terror. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Hezbollah, a looming second front in the war on terror. My guest is correspondent Jeffrey Goldberg. He's a writer with the New Yorker magazine, has had a couple of eye-popping articles in the New Yorker this month entitled In the Party of God, a two-part series over the last 2 weeks. He describes in great detail and across several continents the activity of Hezbollah, and I have to say it was pretty astonishing stuff to me. The question is for you, has Hezbollah even been on your screen? And does American war with Iraq mean Israeli war with Hezbollah? Might they come 1-2? Is this the second shoe that will drop? And I guess finally, is this America's fight? Can Israel handle it alone? Should it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. talk. Jeffrey Goldberg, you had so much rich and surprising detail in these pieces. I wish you'd give us a few snapshots of some of the most vivid scenes that you saw in the Lebanon area, in South America, even things that you saw in the United States. Give us some of those kind of really vivid demonstrations of Hezbollah's extent and determination.
Well, you know, one thing that fascinates me about Hezbollah is that just like Al-Qaeda, it has this global reach and it shows up in the most unexpected places.
You described the three borders at the intersection of Brazil, yeah, Argentina, and Paraguay.
Absolutely fascinating place people don't know about, I didn't know about. It's called the Triple Frontier. It's this lawless zone or semi-lawless zone where Brazil, Paraguay, and Argentina meet. Pretty thickly forested. There are a couple of cities there, and in these cities there are a large number of Lebanese traders. In this population of Arab Muslims, Hezbollah has rooted itself. And I was in this city, Ciudad del Este, which is this kind of rough frontier town in Paraguay. A lot of illegal businesses, drug smuggling and counterfeiting and pirating, all kinds of nasty business there. And I'm wandering around, and there's a mosque called the Mosque of the Prophet Muhammad. Mm-hmm. And I walk in, and when you walk inside, there's a huge portrait of Sheikh Fadlallah, who's the spiritual leader of Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you're in Paraguay and you see this, you think, whoa, this is this is a group that has really planted itself in many different parts of the world, and like Al-Qaeda, or even more so than Al-Qaeda, has spent years building capabilities, building financial capabilities and operational capabilities in the most unlikely places.
And what does it mean beyond the theater of the mosque and the photograph in terms of financial flows, in terms of global operations?
What it means is that Hezbollah's shakedown operation in that area, by shakedown operation, I mean that they extort money from legitimate or semi-legitimate Arab businessmen in that region. That shakedown operation sends somewhere around $10 or $12 million in a good year to Hezbollah in Lebanon. What it also means, more importantly, this is another terrorist act that Hezbollah committed that people in this country tend to not know about or forget about. Hezbollah and Iran together in 1994 blew up a Jewish community center in Argentina.
With a lot of loss of life.
86 people. It was the worst single-day anti-Semitic attack since the end of World War II. That operation was run out of this Triple Frontier area. So it's not just a financial capability or a safe haven. They have the operational capability to strike in many parts of South America.
You describe money-raising activities in the United States, one based in North Carolina.
Yes. Yes, that's true. The federal government just broke up a ring in North Carolina, a Hezbollah ring that was smuggling cigarettes. They were buying low-tax cigarettes in North Carolina, driving them to Michigan, and using some of that money to buy military equipment to ship to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Global positioning systems, night vision goggles, that sort of thing. And according to the law enforcement officials I spoke to, this cell in Charlotte, North Carolina, had the capacity, they believe, to go operational. In other words, not simply to be engaged in illegal financial activities, but to commit terrorism if they were called upon to commit terrorism.
Jeffrey Goldberg, let's invite our callers in again. David is on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello. Good topic. What I'd like to comment about is the caller, the Lebanese caller that from South Lebanon that was talking about Hezbollah.
Yes, just a few minutes ago, Abed.
That's correct. Well, that person, he has no ground at all what Hezbollah is doing, and then he's driven by his religion. That's what I believe. Hezbollah is absolutely a terrorist group.
How do you know that, David? Do you have firsthand experience?
I am Lebanese as well. I'm American Lebanese.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm completely on the opposite
perspective.
What the gentleman said. My belief, if I may say, that Hezbollah is not more than a hand to Syria and Iran. Iran is driven by its religion revolution, and they need the ground next to Israel, and they've been pushing for it since the revolution of Iran, 1979.
And through Hezbollah, they've got it.
They've got Hezbollah, actually. The Syrian, they used to have something similar to Hezbollah, which is the Palestinian, the PLO back then. The PLO was at some part the hand of the Syrian. The Syria, they all, the Syrians always like to have an open wound in if I may say that, in Israel, and Israel side.
Well, and we've got that too. David, our time is running down, but thank you for your call. I want to get one more call in. Another David is on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Well, thanks.
Your guest here seems to be intent in whipping us into a Likud-like hysteria, or joining them in their numerous mistakes. I mean, we need a massive outbreak of reasonableness in that part of the world.
How would that look to you? What would constitute that, David?
Simple. We back the left wing in Israel that wants to get the people out of the settlements. We've got to kill Al Qaeda. We've got to kill Hezbollah. But we get our military out of Saudi Arabia. We make common cause with the reasonable people in Iran.
But you're saying kill Al Qaeda, kill Hezbollah. That suggests military action, but plus something else. You're saying.
Yeah, of a small, of a very focused and stealthy sort. Not these stupid invasions like we're planning in Iraq.
And what is it you want to get away from? What perspective do you want to get away from, David?
The idea that that you cannot make concessions to people who are shooting at you. That's what you do in a complicated, violent situation. You need both carrots and sticks. You know, the idea that you can't give in to the people who are shooting at you because that's somehow going to reward them for shooting at you, that's nonsensical.
David, we've got it. Let me put it to Jeffrey Goldberg. Jeffrey, you've seen the operations on both sides of that border. Is there a different kind of reason that can be brought into play here, or is this power politics? Is this the barrel of a gun situation?
Well, the caller's confusing about eight different issues. With the Palestinians, sure, you want Israel to reach a reasonable compromise with the Palestinians, Palestinians who are willing to live side by side, Israel and a Palestinian state. With Hezbollah, you're dealing with something completely different. Hezbollah wants to wipe out Israel. They're really, I find it very hard to argue why Israel should negotiate with a group that is bent on its extermination. I would also add one more point. The Hezbollah reaction to Israel's pullout. Mm. Remember in the year 2000, Israel did what the world wanted it to do, pull out of Lebanon, leave Lebanon alone.
Under Ehud
Hezbollah
Barak.
Did not react by becoming moderate. Hezbollah reacted, and the quotes are all there in the story. Hezbollah reacted by becoming more extremist and seeing Israel's compromise move as an invitation to further battle.
We've got just a few seconds left, but there had been 18 years of effort in that area. Could Israel come back in a different way and somehow accomplish what they were not able to before?
That's a very tough question. I would say that one would hope Israel learned from its mistakes the first time around. One would hope, more to the point, one would hope that the American government would pressure Syria and Iran to have Hezbollah stand down so it doesn't come to an armed conflict. Israel can blow them up if they want, but that would probably not be the last chapter in that story.
Jeffrey Goldberg, we thank you for the reach and vigor of your reporting. It was really eye-opening. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His articles, two-part series, In the Party of God, appeared in October issues of that magazine. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, David McCullough on the importance of history in times of crisis. This is On Point. Suicide bombings, biological warfare, potential nuclear threats in the hands of Iraq and North Korea. It is a scary world out there. But don't despair, says historian David McCullough. History is full of monumental predicaments that the human spirit has ultimately overcome. Here are excerpts from David McCullough's speech, A Sense of History in Times of Crisis, delivered last night at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
A great deal about our country has changed since September 11th. And some of the change that has taken place is perhaps greater than we know and has more far-reaching consequences than we can yet know. But everything hasn't changed, by any means. And one of the things that hasn't changed is our history. And our history is an infinite, inexhaustible source of strength, inspiration, guidance. People were saying after September 11th, these are the worst, most dangerous, most uncertain times we've ever been through. Well, they are dangerous, uncertain times, to be sure. And it seems they grow more so by the day. But they are not the worst we have ever been through, by any means. And this sense that we have been through more difficult, trying times in the past is important to understand deep inside of ourselves if we are to measure up to what we face as time proceeds. John Adams was asked once in the midst of the War of 1812 about this question of, is this the worst we've ever been through? And Adams wrote a wonderful answer. He said, you ask, this was written in 1814, you ask if I ever have known more difficult and dangerous times. Yes, infinitely more difficult and dangerous times. Every moment from 1761 to 1774 was more difficult and dangerous than this. I've seen a time when Congress was chased like a covey of partridges from Philadelphia to Trenton, from Trenton to Lancaster, from Lancaster to Yorktown, and Yorktown to Baltimore. By Yorktown, he means York, Pennsylvania. I have seen the time when Washington was hunted through New Jersey from Brandywine to Valley Forge, and we all had ropes about our necks then, and axes and hurdles before our eyes. We have been through worse times than this in the Civil War, certainly, much worse. In the great influenza epidemic of 1918-1919, when, for some reason, we seem to forget about that terrible experience, that terrible national experience, when over 500,000 people died in an epidemic disease for which no one had any cure, no way to stop it. 500,000 people, considering the population of the time, if that were to happen today, be well over a million people dying all around us. They said there wasn't a family in the country that didn't lose someone. And then the Depression. And then the Second World War. I don't think there was ever, certainly not in the lifetime of anyone in this room, ever a darker time than the last few weeks of 1941 and the first months of 1942. When the Nazi machine was running rampant, Hitler's armies were almost to Moscow. North Africa was in their hands. German submarines were sinking our oil tankers and other ships right off the coast of New Jersey and Florida within sight of the beaches, and there was nothing we could do about it. Half our Navy had been destroyed at Pearl Harbor. Our new recruits were drilling with wooden rifles. We had no Air Force. Who was to say that we would stop the Nazi machine? Nothing ever had to happen the way it happened. Nothing ever had to turn out the way it turned out. Those people in the revolution had no guarantee that they were going to succeed. If anything, all the reverse looked most likely. And it's the same in 1941-42. Late in 1941, Winston Churchill came across the Atlantic, the North Atlantic, again in winter, in the midst of war. And he gave a great speech, a major speech. And I want to quote one sentence from that speech to end with. He said, "We haven't come this far because we're made of sugar candy." And he wasn't just a great world leader. He was an historian.
An excerpt from historian David McCullough's speech, A Sense of History in Times of Crisis, delivered last night at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is WBUR. We're funded by